where we had a pipeline group working for the citizens of Alaska, moving a pipeline forward, we have pretty actively just neutered it, Mr. Chairman.
The in-state gas line loses momentum in the Senate. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a U.S.-Russia ice seal survey gets underway in the Bering Sea.
The infrared cameras are used to locate seals on the ice, and then once we've located the seal, we use the digital cameras to identify the seal to species.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Association of Alaska School Boards promotes one-to-one digital learning for all Alaska students to prepare them for success in the global economy. More information at aasb.org. This message sponsored by the Association of Alaska School Boards.
The FBI has confirmed that they are investigating the deaths of two Coast Guard employees yesterday morning in Kodiak as a double homicide. Bureau spokesman Eric Gonzalez did not identify a suspect who is still at large. The victims have been identified as Coast Guard Petty Officer First Class James Hopkins, an electronics technician, and Richard Belisle, a civilian employee and retired Coast Guard Chief Petty Officer. The two men were found shot to death in one of the buildings at Communication Station Kodiak by co-workers when they arrived between 7 and 8 a.m. yesterday. The comm stay is a high security area responsible for radio communications across the North Pacific and Bering Sea. Coast Guard Captain Carl Moore said because of the sensitive nature of the area, there are several video surveillance cameras in the vicinity. He said the FBI will be reviewing them. Since the killings took place on federal property, the FBI has jurisdiction. Military police, the Coast Guard Investigating Service, and the Alaska State Troopers are assisting. Security patrols at the Coast Guard base and the surrounding residential neighborhoods have been increased, but the base and Peterson Elementary School, which is on base, were open today. Rear Admiral Thomas Ostebo, commander of the 17th Coast Guard District, said a number of crisis response personnel and resources have been sent to Kodiak to assist the victims' families, friends, and co-workers to cope with the tragic event. An in-state gas line might have moved a little further into the shadows today, as a House bill setting up a pipeline from the North Slope to South Central lost most of its content in the Senate. The measure has been the top priority of House Speaker Mike Chenault for the past 2 years, and was on the list of bills the governor supports and has said would be on the call for a possible special session. The Senate's Community and Regional Affairs Committee this morning introduced a new version that was described as an attempt to provide the minimum resources and authority for the project to advance. However, sponsor Chenault said the committee's idea of requiring legislative approval for further action adds a political element to a construction project.
Where we had a pipeline group working for the citizens of Alaska, moving a pipeline forward that is the only pipeline project in this state that is moving forward at this time, we have pretty actively just neutered it, Mr. Chairman.
The primary elements in the Senate bill fit the requirement the governor described to the Alaska Budget Report in an interview published yesterday. There are still a lot of issues hanging in the legislature as we head into the final hours this weekend. Joining us from the Capitol is APRN's Dave Donaldson. Hi, Dave.
Hi there.
Dave, is this in-state gas line bill and the changes made in the Senate a deal killer? Does it have a real effect on the session?
Not yet. It's important. It's really important. But it still can be salvaged if no one goes around burning bridges behind them. The governor might have overstepped the legislative relationships here when he did this interview with the budget report. But there were a lot of elements already in that House bill that the Senate simply was not going to accept. So the governor just simply took a step, described a minimum of things that had to go this year. If the Senate jumped on that as a possible solution to things, you know, they may have jumped a little too hard, particularly putting in this idea about having the legislature approving anything further. That can be fixed. It still can be fixed. And I don't think that we have to consider that this thing is really dead at this point.
What else is essential for this year?
Well, good news. The conference committee finished work on the operating budget this afternoon, and it's going to be ready for a vote on Sunday. There's no news on the capital projects budget. It's getting sour, really, on the desktops. It's just sitting there on the finance committee. Finance committee is recessed to a call of the chair, and although all sides and everybody's saying it's okay, it's all been worked out. The oil tax, the Senate caucused on it again today within the majority, bipartisan majority group. They did not come to any conclusions. It looked really grim, still does. You know, it's not over, but it sort of was as if when they left that caucus today, they seemed to have pulled the life support system out of it. I just don't see how they're going to bring it back, but I've been really surprised in the past. We'll just have to wait and see.
Dave, you mentioned education funding as a major element when we talked yesterday. When and where is that?
There is a bill moving around. It's actually on the floor, on the desks also of the House Finance Committee that is not met on it today, does not discuss it, but it is there and active. It provides funding right now just for pupil transportation. They'll pay for the bus charges, and that's a big element of all school districts' funding. It's a kind of a crossbreed between the approach the governor wants, which is to pay for specific elements, and at the other side, it does allow some sort of a formula base on how these elements will be paid for. So the idea is that it's at least possible that a more complete fix can come out of that particular bill. It's the only thing that I see moving right now. It's not sufficient to meet all the requirements, but it's a working platform. So all we have to do is just see where that bill goes, how it's worked with, and see who starts to build on that platform.
Well, thanks for that update, Dave.
My pleasure.
APRN's Dave Donaldson reporting from Juneau. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an effort to reopen a Fairbanks murder trial.
Nobody's saying go do something foolish. Nobody's saying go unlock a prison door and let people out just because we say so. We're saying use the tools that are right there at your fingertips.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
Anchorage officials are still trying to sort out the ballot mess from the April 3rd municipal election. Last week, nearly half of the precincts ran out of ballots, and some voters reported they were turned away at the polls. Today, the Anchorage Assembly held a special work session. The municipal clerk, the election commission, and the municipal attorney presented data that left the body with more questions than answers. The municipal clerk delivered a letter to the assembly recommending they engage an independent investigator, something the ACLU of Alaska called for earlier this week. The assembly chair says it's likely they'll take a vote on the matter at their next regular meeting, Tuesday, April 17th. In Dillingham, the final results are in from Tuesday's special election, and both ballot questions passed. On ballot question one, voters approved annexing the Nooshagak Commercial Fishing District and the Wood River Special Harvest Area into the Dillingham city limits. On ballot question two, Dillingham voters have approved imposing a 2.5% local fish tax. It's estimated to bring $700,000 in additional revenue to the city of Dillingham. A reward for new information about an old Fairbanks murder has increased. The Tanana Chiefs Conference is offering $35,000 for information leading to exoneration of four interior men, three of whom are Alaska Native, imprisoned for the 1997 beating death of Fairbanks teenager John Hartman. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The men known as the Fairbanks Four, George Freese, Kevin Pease, Marvin Roberts, and Eugene Vent, have spent the last 15 years in jail for killing John Hartman. Juries convicted them, but there have always been questions given a lack of physical evidence, alcohol-affected memories, discredited interrogation techniques used on the young men, and allegations of racism. Tanana Chiefs Conference Justice Task Force Chair Shirley Lee says the case has long been an issue for the Interior Native organization.
The tribes of the TCC region have brought this case particularly to convention every year for the last 10-plus years, asking for us to look into it because it's representative of what might have occurred in other cases involving Alaska Natives.
The TCC Reward Fund has grown sevenfold from donations over the last year. The Alaska Innocence Project, which investigates wrongful convictions, is working the Fairbanks 4 case. The Fairbanks 4 have exhausted their appeal options, and efforts to exonerate them are focused on getting a new trial or a pardon from the governor. A resurgence of attention on the case over the last year has been driven by an online effort started by April Monroe Frick, an Alaska Native woman who knew the men when they were teenagers together back in the 1990s. Monroe Frick manages a website, blog, Facebook page, and online petition, all aimed at finding new evidence and exoneration. She says there's consensus among thousands who've logged on that justice was not served, but authorities aren't listening.
The message that our leaders have gotten is abundantly clear. Nobody's saying go do something foolish. Nobody's saying go unlock a prison door and let people out just because we say so. We're saying use the tools that are right there at your fingertips.
State legal officials have refused comment on the Fairbanks 4 case. Fairbanks Police Chief Laren Zager says the local department is satisfied that the convictions are valid, but will take action if new issues or evidence are raised.
People that are still alive that we can interview, material that we could send to the lab to look for a specific person's DNA. If anything like that would come up, I would absolutely reopen the investigation.
No one is hoping more that will happen than the four convicted men. Reached in prison, Marvin Roberts says they appreciate the efforts being made to free them.
From the bottom of my heart, I want to say thank you to everybody who prayed for us, who supported us, who continues to pray for us, and who continues to support us. We're really grateful to everybody.
Eugene Vent mirrors that optimism, citing the new wave of support.
After April and then started the blog, I've just been getting hearing from people that I've been out of contact with for years, and it just feels good because a lot of people are like family, and you know, it gives me hope, and it's wonderful. It's wonderful news every time I hear about it.
Vent says he hopes their story helps others wrongly imprisoned. Vent and George Freese initially confessed to kicking John Hartman, but later recanted. Freese says he was scared by interrogators.
Statements that both me and Gina both made does not corroborate anything or the police theory or anything. Completely impossible for us to have done it.
The story that's unfolded online over the last year includes posts from people who placed the young men away from the crime scene at the time of the Hartman murder. Kevin Pease says much of the information never made it into their trials.
They're putting everything out there and letting everything be heard. And it's great. I mean, I'm glad my story's being told now.
Pease says he can't wait to get back to court if that ever happens. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A joint effort by scientists from the U.S. and Russia to estimate the abundance of ice seals in the Bering Sea kicked off this week. KDLG's Dave Benninger caught up with the team at Dillingham Airport and has the story.
It's a sunny day in Bristol Bay, and researchers from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration are loading gear into a sparkling twin otter plane at the airfield in Dillingham. They're about to fly the first of many aerial surveys to estimate the abundance of ice seals in the Bering Sea. Dr. Michael Cameron is the lead researcher on this team.
Originally for today, we had planned to go to St. Paul,
conducting a survey on en route, but some fog at St. Paul kind of forcing us to hold off on that for another day, so we're going to do a round robin.
This is a joint effort by the U.S. and Russia and should be the largest survey of its kind in history. Over the next 6 to 8 weeks, NOAA scientists and investigators will be flying thousands of miles all over the Bering Sea and surrounding waters using sophisticated optics to locate and photograph seals hauled out on ice. The plane is one of four used by NOAA for marine mammal research and came up from MacDill Air Force Base in Florida. The two pilots are NOAA commissioned officers who could be mistaken for Navy or Air Force pilots, but prefer not to be. Lieutenant J.G. Tanner Sims is the lead pilot on today's flight.
You know, we're shooting for about 15,000 miles of track line for the ideal case, but we'll just see what the Alaskan weather can give us. That'll be spread out probably around over about 30 flights, so 6 to 8 weeks, so it's ambitious.
So as not to spook the seals off the ice, they'll fly at 800 to 1,000 feet, and infrared optics will record the exact moments the plane passed over any seal on the ice below. An array of digital cameras will snap photographs once every second.
So that box right there, that's the whole sensor package. You'll see three high-resolution digital cameras pointed at angle, and then after that, you'll see three infrared cameras that are pointed at the exact same angles. So the infrared cameras are used to locate seals on the ice. And then once we've located the seal, we use the digital cameras to identify the seal to species.
Ribbon, bearded, spotted, and ring seals will be the focus of this intensive survey. But Dr. Cameron anticipates seeing only two of the four types today.
So we expect to see a lot of spotted seals and harbor seals kind of mixed in together. Bristol Bay is one of the only locations that both species tend to hang out in together. For a while, spotted seals and harbor seals were thought to be the same species, just harbor seals. It wasn't until the 70s with some genetics work that we realized that there actually was a separate species, the spotted seal, so it's kind of exciting. Even when you have them right in hand, even experienced field biologists have difficulty telling the difference between the two species.
The two-year joint ice seal survey will cost about $2 million, and the U.S. is picking up the tab for both countries. The mandate for this research is the Marine Mammal Protection Act of 1972, which calls for an understanding of the ecology and population of marine mammals. Other methods to survey seals in the past proved inadequate for a variety of reasons, and the U.S. and Russia tried smaller joint surveys back in the 80s, but the Russians don't seem to have any of that data anymore. So both countries will conduct an aerial survey this spring, and again next spring, and researchers will analyze the mountain of photographs and data in between. Colleagues in other fields have been asking to get their hands on the valuable data at the end of the survey, so NOAA says they hope there will be collateral benefits for researchers in ice modeling, cetacean studies, and so on.
Too long, but we can
on the runway in Dillingham, the team has changed into bright orange jumpsuits and have loaded the last of the gear onto the plane. The pilot gives a runway mission brief, and they board.
All right, guys, I'm going to close you up.
And away they go. A 4 to 5 hour flight, the first of dozens of flights in some 15,000 miles to come in the largest effort ever to survey the ice seals in the Bering Sea. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Shaylin Cochran. This week on AK, remembering the tsunami. On March 27, 1964, a 9.2 magnitude earthquake struck Alaska. The tsunami that followed killed more than 100 people and devastated many communities. The village of Old Harbor on Kodiak Island was almost completely destroyed. Only two homes and a church remained standing. Recently, radio producers Elizabeth Meister and Dan Collison visited Old Harbor and spoke with Mary Hawkinson and the Reverend Gregory Parker of Three Saints Russian Orthodox Church about the earthquake and tsunami.
On a pleasant afternoon, March 27, 1964. Good Friday, as a matter of fact.
We were just sitting down to eat dinner.
Then, at 5:36, a dozen miles deep, under the mountains north of Prince William Sound, the earth shivers, begins to move.
It was really strong. You could hear the church bell ringing, and smokestacks were falling, and it was scary. My husband wasn't here. He went out to get some lumber for the coffee shop we were going to build. And I was there with the girls.
Suddenly, the whole harbor of Valdez is sucked dry.
All the water went out, and they could see the ocean floor.
Out in the Gulf of Alaska, the ocean bottom seems to sink.
The whole bay was dry. This whole bay, I never knew there were so many rocks out there.
Then heaves upward 50 feet, sending a giant wave towards shore.
So somebody called and said, get up to the hill, there's tidal wave. So I just took the girls, ran up the hill, and we stayed there all night.
And the flood came in, the waters came in, and in the back surge, most everything was sucked out.
Small outlying villages all on Kodiak Island were almost completely destroyed. Only a handful of houses remained. Houses still intact were driven miles across the water.
I didn't watch it. I was with the girls. I was hanging on to them so they won't get cold. We just had to cuddle up together.
And then, all over Alaska, as suddenly as it had come, it was gone.
I was 6 months pregnant when I took the girls up there with me. I lost the baby. And next day they went down, they said, we're not going to leave till we clean the church. So they went down there to clean it. Not a candle fell, nothing. It was clean the way we left it.
When there was a great tidal wave, you caused the stormy seas to cease fire prayers before the icon of the Mother of God, saying, the water shall not go beyond this line.
You'll go to places where there are iron and concrete structures, and they're all twisted up and destroyed. But this humble wooden church with a very strong foundation, it survived that tsunami.
The water shall not go beyond this line, therefore we sing to you thus.
That's a story that the Orthodox across the world talk about, especially in North America, and with a little bit of bragging rights too. The Baptists were wiped out. This church survived. This church stood.
Rejoice, wondrous pacifier of the waters.
We were in Kodiak for a while, then they shipped us to Anchorage, and we were there till May.
You know, Sven Hawkinson Sr., Mary's husband, it was his vision in particular that they weren't going to abandon Old Harbor, because this church remained standing.
My husband said, we're coming back. Our church is here. We're coming back with our people.
They wanted to maintain what they had. And what they had wasn't in material things. What they had was their faith in God and their subsistence culture. And the will to just keep trudging along, even in the face of all that devastation.
God was watching over us.
That was Mary Hawkinson and the Reverend Gregory Parker speaking about the 1964 Good Friday earthquake and tsunami. The piece was produced by Elizabeth Meister and Dan Collison, who visited Kodiak last fall. Their trip was funded by the Rasmussen Foundation and hosted by the Aleutic Museum. And now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're going north to Point Hope. The community of about 800 people on the Chukchi Sea is anxiously waiting for the right conditions to begin spring whaling.
My name is Steve Lunka, City of Point Hope Mayor.
We are mostly Inupiaq community. We are whale hunters of Point Hope, and everybody's getting ready for whaling. And we got the skin boots skinned and ice cellars cleaned, and the sun is up, and it's finally above zero for the first time in since December. Point Hope is centered around whaling. I've been hunting whales for over 2,000 years. We're a very traditional community. We still hunt the whale in our skin boat. We live out in a point on the northwest tip of the North Slope. And the animals migrate right through our path. And that's why, you know, that we've been here for thousands of years, because, you know, the food is here. Everybody's excited. You know, we had a very cold winter and several months of darkness, and it's always good to welcome the sun back in the daylight and all the animals and, you know, gather the food that is given to us by nature. People are welcome into our community. We have a celebration in the second Sunday of June that lasts 3 days on the whale feast when we're successful. And we've, you know, everybody's always welcome to the feast on the second Sunday, Monday and Tuesday of June.
Steve Umtuck is the mayor of Point Hope. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK on Alaska News Nightly. We had help this week from Annie Fite, Dave Waldron, Elizabeth Meister, and Dan Collison. Be sure to tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Shaylin Cochran.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Dave Benninger in Dillingham. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
You can find APRN headlines from around the state online at alaskapublic.org. There you'll discover local and worldwide news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.